Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. Good of you to pull yourself away from that incredibly boring Bears game. My guest this first 45 minutes, a rare 45-minute rather than 30-minute interview, is my colleague and friend, Jeff Cohn of the Tribune, but more importantly, the author of a stunning, stunning book, Murder in Canaryville, The True Story Behind a Cold Case and a Chicago Cover-Up. Jeff, how are you?
Rick, I am doing well. It's very good to hear your voice after all these months.
I know. This is such a drag. It's such a drag not seeing friends.
I have not talked to you. I can't remember the last time. I'm sure it was spring.
Yeah, it could have been spring. Something about your new baby. The subtitle of this book is True Story Behind a Cold Case and a Chicago Cover-Up. I would hazard to say, and I have not encountered many more cold cases, this was really a freezing case. It involved the shooting death of a young man with a lot of potential named John Hughes. He died at Mercy Hospital at 1:20 a.m. on May 15th, 1976. You could not possibly have known about this case before coming upon it years later, much like the hero of this book, a copper named Jim Sherlock. Had you even any hint of this case before that?
You know, I was trying to think if I had, because I did have some decent relationships with, special prosecutions types when I worked at 26 in California,
sure,
the criminal courthouse,
sure,
here. But I don't remember it specifically, and you're right, it was pretty well locked away for many years. I think, the main reason that Sherlock really decided to pick it up was the questions about the police involvement in it. And he had, as a career police officer here, he had so many friends and mentors who were aware of it, that's for sure, that they kept talking about it. And so he kind of took a flyer on it as he was getting ready to retire. Otherwise, I would still
talk to me about him. He is one of the most sort of quietly heroic figures I've ever encountered. You bring up the old film called Northside 777 as a example of Jimmy Stewart playing a very dogged reporter going after a thing. This guy, Sherlock, is as dogged can be. You write in the book, and I'm going to read some stuff, because I think the book is beautifully written. No, the secrets would not come easily. Jim Sherlock knew it, and that was fine. Lost causes are the only ones worth fighting for, Clarence Darrow supposedly once said. Maybe that's what this was. Whatever truth was buried here, whatever the streets of Bridgeport and Canaryville would dish out, he would take. He was as Chicago as they were. In some ways, the perfect person to take this up and not look back. When he took this up, when did you and Sherlock talk?
He was pretty well winding down, I think, and had some frustrations with it. He had actually read my first book, Family Secrets, and I think he was interested in, if this tale could ever potentially be told. I think he felt like I would understand some of the characters that were involved in it.
Sure.
As you would. And so he brought it to me at one point, and we started to talk. And then as he was closing it, I kind of restarted it myself.
Yeah, you would have. Sure, sure.
As a journalist, I went back over it. I wound up interviewing myself, some of the key people that he talked to, the key witness in the case, one of the police officers who worked it at the time, who was sure that there were all kinds of dark forces at work against it. I spoke to him myself, and as I kind of built it myself, I saw what Sherlock did, which was that there were some real problems here. And I do think he was the perfect person to handle it. I think for a lot of reasons, he is from there.
Right.
And I think he's a grandfather police officer that he really looked up to. He's got other cops in his family. He's got a couple of boys who are on right now. And I think it just did not sit with him that this one would just fade into history. He just didn't want it to happen.
Well, it was on the face of it when you do a remarkable job. That first chapter is really stunning. It almost brings me to tears, frankly, when, this is sort of an innocent guy. This is not a time when every teenager in the world had a gun. This was a relatively innocent era. It was what would have been a year before under different circumstances, just a fist fight, and it wound up killing this kid. John Hughes must have haunted you a bit, too, in that you have a picture at the beginning of the book where you dedicate the book to your wife and child, and the picture for me is really haunting. There's a real innocence about that, you know, whatever it was, a class photo or something. You must have felt, yeah. You must have felt some kind of, I don't know, Jeff, if you felt a duty to do this kid right, but there was something about him, was there not? The way you detail him, he was admired, he had a lot of friends, he wasn't a bad guy. He must have gotten under your skin a bit, too.
He did quite a bit. I think that you characterized this correctly, first of all, that it was a more innocent time. Huh. I was honestly shocked that I went, you know, one of the first steps you would do as a reporter is go look for clips.
Yeah.
There weren't any.
There weren't any. That's a stunning.
No, it was. Yeah. It was really. It's a period when Chicago, like now, but even more so, had hundreds of murders a year.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine if this happened today, you know, a teenager, let's face it, white kid gets killed in the middle of a city park, it would have been stories for days.
Yeah.
You know, probably. You know, unfairly so.
No question. Would, you know, you would have profiled everyone in his family. He had a very big family.
Yeah,
we got to take a break now, but I'm keeping Jeff Cohn on until, well, maybe until the Bears score again, but at least 60, at least until a quarter to seven. Because the book, he is the author of three books, Family Secrets, which he was just talking about, the case that crippled the Chicago mob in 2009. Then with the great John Chase, who no longer works with us, Golden, how Rod Blagojevich was Rod Blagojevich. We'll be back in 2 minutes. When investigator Jim Sherlock and my colleague, Jeff Cohn began digging. They did it separately, but then Jeff kept digging. They ran into a lot of people who would be interviewed, but who would say, "I don't want this about me. I don't want this about me." You really had to dig into that lengthy and tortured kind of history of Canaryville and Bridgeport, didn't you, Jeff? Did it surprise you or shock you? And you're not a naive guy, and you've been around crime and criminal justice and occasionally punishment for a long time. Did it surprise you?
Yeah, it did. You know, in a lot of ways, I mean, I know those neighborhoods not well. I'm not from there.
Sure.
But just in the course of my work, you know, I think everybody comes across those neighborhoods. And, you know, I know it as kind of the mayor's the Daily's old stronghold.
Yep.
So, yeah, I did. It did take quite a bit of coaxing for some people and promises for me that if they spoke to me, it wouldn't be about them. And you
right.
can see two or three different places where that came up in the book. And you had asked earlier about, you know, this getting under my skin.
Right.
And it did a bit. And, you know, part of that was the John Hughes' sister did speak to me for the book. And I basically had to promise her that this wasn't going to be, you know, basically a cheap handling or, you know, true crime thrill book.
Sure, sure.
Based off her brother's death. And so that's part of the reason for the photo in the front. And part of the reason it did stick with me was I felt like, kind of like Sherlock did, that if there's this kind of a story sitting in the city untold, then it was sort of my duty to tell that and not let that go unexposed.
Well, you must have realized at some point, as some retired commander told Sherlock when he began his exploration of this, is an incredible quote, "When you start looking into this, buckle up." It was a case, would you not say, Jeff Cohn, that should have, might have, and should have been easy to solve had police officers and their bosses done the right thing at the beginning.
Yeah, and that really haunted Sherlock as well, because he knew, you know, even some of the cops that he knew later on and that he interviewed for this himself, he knew that these were good cops. These are guys who solve cases like this all the time. It's it's two groups of kids fighting in a couple of parks. It's not
And a green car. I mean, the green car is like one of the monsters of this entire book.
Right. It's not the Lindbergh baby.
Exactly.
So you put the right few kids in front of a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
You lock them in. you know, people that don't cooperate, you threaten to charge them, and somebody cracks inevitably, especially when we're talking about teenagers.
Teenagers
going to give somebody up.
Right, right. As you write in the book, when Sherlock's digging into this, you write, what should have been a massive file with notes and transcripts from dozens of interviews had been reduced to a few seemingly random sheets of paper from reports and a couple of photographs. Sherlock could have left the record center without the folder and cruised into retirement without taking on the case after all, and no one would have noticed. Instead, he tucked the envelope under his arm and carried it outside. Were there any moments, Jeff, when you too, in a sense, decided not to give this up, when it got frustrating for you?
Yeah, there were times, and actually right at the beginning for me, as he was explaining kind of what he had found, I sort of had to take a deep breath and say, well, you know, for me to be able to write some of this, it's going to take a lot more work. This is not, you know, some breakaway layup here. You know, and I realized that I was going to want to do my own work on it. I wasn't just going to want to take a pile of, you know, whatever reports Sherlock put together. You know, while I could have written it out of that, I didn't want to stop there. I wanted to talk to some of these people myself and kind of make an assessment like he did about, you know, their credibility as witnesses. And I found them to be, you know, very credible as he did, trying to hang a criminal case on their words. You know, and I found, we were talking about Bridgeport, I kind of found that down-to-earth flavor there to be pretty compelling as far as people's memories and what stuck with them. You could tell that this was something that haunted them.
No question.
In kind of that old Chicago way, they, you know, sure as hell remembered exactly where they were and what happened and which cop said what to them and why they weren't, you know, why they were discounted and in some cases, you know, made fun of. And Mary, who's the key eyewitness, you know, was called a drunk and basically
a drunk and a slut and
virtually tossed out on her ear when she was their witness.
Yeah.
And she was going to help them solve it. So he, I think, you know, you talk about the folder that he gets right at the beginning.
Right.
I think he sort of went there with all these rumors in his head about what this case was supposed to be, and oh, there's mob influence, and there's political influence, and there's a crooked judge in there. And so he goes to the record center, and when he gets that envelope, it clicked for him. He's like, this is true. He
said, exactly.
I got a couple calls to make. I got to talk to this witness, but looking at this, it seems to be true. And the more he dug into it, the things that were there were the kinds of things that you would put there if you were just trying to put some icing on a cover-up and make it look like you did your work. Like,
exactly. I mean, it wasn't a green car. It was another kind of car. Also, the cast of characters that you bring to life in this book, which is Murder in Canaryville, easily, I think it's published, pub date is maybe Tuesday. You can easily find it almost anywhere. You know, I'm just going to rattle off some names. I mean, Fermanek, Costello, Townsend, Ferraro, any one of these guys could be the star of a some kind of mob movie. But shadowing it all, is the king of Bridgeport, the Daly family, and the Daly seem to have literally, and you can understand this, relationships with many of the principals in Murder in Canaryville. Sort of easy to understand that. Talk to me for a second, Jeff. One of the great tragic figures in this book is a woman named Martha DeCaro.
Right.
Who was the girlfriend of a not-so-nice kid in who lived in the neighborhood and who was murdered. I think he got off, but that's another matter. You must have felt for her, too. I mean, she seems, if not maybe naive, but also very innocent to me.
Yeah, I think very much so. And you know, she's another, you're right, tragic character. Oh. I mean, I think another reason that the whole story needed to be told, because I think people would have, you know, forgotten about her murder. And you know, I think you would have remembered it because of things that you wound up doing in your career. But
sure,
other people would have forgotten it. But honestly, yeah, the characters and the different tentacles here and the directions that this went off, it would be... But, you know, times and better times, Rick, if we were sitting at the Billy Goat and you tell some of your favorite stories and some of the best Chicago stories, have tangents that go on, and then before you know it, the one little story you've tried to tell takes 45 minutes because you're talking about what other people are involved in it, and you know this is like the world's biggest small town. And so you had all these different connections, which this story kind of let me go off and write about.
Well, I'm glad it let you go off and write about it, because one of the hallmarks of this book is, yes, you, from the title, you're getting Murder in Canaryville, the true story of a cold case and a Chicago cover-up. You are getting so many more, and I so admire the way you, I cannot even imagine organizationally how you did this. There are other cases that come into this, and other players in the sordid world of Chicago. There is one chapter called A Troubling, chapter 15 is A Troubling Legacy, that takes us all from Hanhart to John Burge to the Austin 7, the Marquette 10, up to Laquan McDonald. I think, did it occur to you, was that purposeful from the beginning, or as you were writing, did you say, wait, I need more context in here. I need to show that this is part of a larger screwed up whole.
Yeah, it's exactly that. I think it needed context.
Yeah.
And it's, imagine, you know, part of the work as I was putting this together in kind of the closing stages, that was happening as the country was dealing with the George Floyd tragedy. And, yeah, Laquan was still pretty fresh, I think, in everyone's mind here, especially in the wake of Floyd and the unrest that followed that. But it just seemed like it needed some context, because if you were to take this story in a vacuum, you would think, oh, this could never happen. This is too many higher ups. It's, you know, too many people who would be compromised by it. But when you really look at the history, and again, yeah, there are many, many very good cops here. And obviously there's one at the center of this book, but if you really take into account all of the terrible things that have happened and all the corruption that we've seen here,
sure,
it starts to sound a lot less far-fetched that a few of them would go in for this. And
yeah,
basically,
I think that your publisher, I mean, not only will readers be pleased by that, but, you know, not that I've forgotten Hanhart and John Burge, but I think other readers will be absolutely enlightened by that. And you do make the case that, look, most cops are good cops, but there are many people who become cops were bad people before they became cops, and here they were faced with a number of sort of interesting temptations. And the characters in, I mean, Mike Belandick's in this thing, Harry Alleman's in this thing, the Spilotro brothers are in this book, the hired truck scandal.
Yeah, and you know, and before we move off the police thing,
sure,
it felt also fair to me, because if you ever need an example of a good cop,
oh,
who is doing the job the right way, first of all, the book's filled with them.
Yeah,
including guys who worked the case at the time.
Absolutely.
But Sherlock especially, I mean, he's exhibit A in my mind about what the job is supposed to be. I mean, this guy did not have to do this work and try to uncover this. He could have been done.
Well, one of the interesting things you point out about Sherlock, too, is over his 30-year career, Sherlock would prove to have a knack for being in the orbit of major events in the department's history, including some of its great tragedies. Again, the title of the book is Murder in Canaryville, the true story of a cold case and the Chicago and a Chicago cover-up, a classic Chicago cover-up. Jeff Cohn, C-O-E-N, is the author. We'll take a little news break, and I'm going to come back, and this must have been, Jeff, such a, think about this, let this rest on your shoulders during the commercials, this must have been such a bear to write. I know you're the author of three books, but this must have been such an organizational bear. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about Jeff's wife, who makes a cameo appearance in the book. We'll be right back. Chicago is a very, very, very difficult place to understand. It always has been, but if you are seeking some enlightenment, I would pick up Murder in Canaryville, the true story behind a cold case and a Chicago cover-up. It is Jeff Cohn's remarkable book about a specific cold case, a poor teenager named John Hughes, who was pronounced dead at 1:20 a.m. on May 15, 1976. But it is also about a culture and two specific neighborhoods, Canaryville and Bridgeport, and about what can go wrong, and about one stunningly heroic guy named Jim Sherlock, who, as you tell in the book, was, when this happened to John, he was a sixth grader at St. Adrian Grammar School. Jeff, in marshaling all of this material, and trying to make it. There are a lot of names in this book. In trying to make it, as you do, clear and precise and sort of moving like a novel, this must have been an organizational, not nightmare, but an organizational challenge for you, was it not?
Yeah, I think as a writer, it presented some unique challenges. Oh, yeah. Which you've just laid out there. I think, you know, it was important to me to kind of camp out on Sherlock's work, though, and tell at least part of it through his eyes and then part of it through my own, you know, in the interviews. Sure. Where I think it kind of stands out and becomes obvious that the writer is speaking to the witness himself.
No question.
But, yeah, I think, first of all, I think that was important to me to start it like I did with the prologue area where Jim Sherlock is sitting across the street from the house of someone who was a teenager.
One of the principals,
believed to have been in the car when the shot was fired. Because that just happened. Jim Sherlock was just out in the far western suburbs, basically on a one-man stakeout. And so I wanted to bring a case that was very, very old into the present. I mean, here's a Chicago police detective on loan to the FBI, working a cold case, sitting in the suburbs in a Jeep Cherokee, watching a house.
And watching the curtains
solve a murder that happened more than 40 years ago. So I wanted to make that part of it live. Yeah. And then there's a natural arc to it a little bit that goes chronological. Yeah. I like the way that it builds into the DeCaro murder because the person is believed to have been sort of suspected of being the shooter in the Hughes murder, goes on to possibly shoot his girlfriend, which we've mentioned, and he apparently gets off on that case, because the bribe was paid to the judge, who you know well from your work.
Yes, I do.
I don't want to leave without you talking about that too.
No, we're going to leave without me telling you about that. I want to have you in when you can come in the studio, because this is a remarkable book on any number of levels, and you have to be. I hope you are incredibly proud of this book. And the fact that I just tossed this out is just another thing you learn in the book. Jim Sherlock at one point was like a security guard for the Jerry Springer show. I mean, there is a surprise on every other page. Right. You are married to the delightful colleague of mine, Tracy Schwartz, and you write in the book, "I particularly would like to thank my wife, Tracy. Work like this usually places stress on other parts of an author's life, both at home and at work, and this was no different. That situation was not helped by the fact that as the writing was coming together, Tracy was preparing to give birth to our daughter, Sloane." I cannot even imagine the sort of emotional stress going on while you wrote this book. And you thank your daughter Sloane for taking naps during the arduous chore of taking naps during this thing. They must
maybe have three or four total.
You are now an editor at the paper. Jeff has had a distinguished career at the paper covering crime and criminal justice, and he is now what is called the crime justice editor. Stories like this just don't. I'm so glad you jumped onto this, because it would have been really easy to even sit there with Sherlock and say, well, you know, that's kind of an interesting story. And I am so glad you chose artfully to give it the kind of context that it needed to make it such a real Chicago book.
I am proud of it, and especially because I feel like, to be perfectly honest, that I'm continuing the legacy of work that guys like you have done. You're one of my personal heroes, as you well know, and I mentioned your book, which scrapes up against this
with Maury Posley. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap. Maury Posley and I wrote a book called Everybody Pays 20 years ago, a cold book, as they call it these days. But I'm glad if I had any part in this, even small, these kind of stories. And I'll tell you another interesting connection. The reporter who, upon which the 1948 film Call Northside 777 was based, wound up in the last years of his career working as my father's assistant on Book Week and the Showcase, which was the art section at the time. And Jack was a remarkable guy. I would sit once I saw that movie. And my father told me about Jack. He was not very forthcoming about the case or anything else. And I would go, "What was it like, Mr. McFaul, to have Jimmy Stewart play you?" And Jack would say, he did an okay job. He did an okay job. Yes. So there is that string through, and you do such a wonderful job. Canaryville is much, in many ways, much like Canaryville was 40 years ago. Bridgeport, not so much anymore. But those are two of Chicago's ever most interesting neighborhoods. Jeff, congratulations. This is quite a book, and let's do this again, because we could talk about crime and justice and mobsters and crooked judges and good cops forever, yeah, I think.
Yeah, I'd love to do it in person, too.
Me too, I miss you and Tracy, and I've yet to see Sloan. I've taken her on as like kind of one of my younger girlfriends, and I've yet to meet her. Jeff, love to the family. I don't know what the Bears game is doing, but go enjoy the rest of it, and congratulations. This is quite a book, man.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Rick.